Welcome to Tower Talks with Inside Towers, the wireless infrastructure industry's podcast. And now for your weekly recap, a timely review of this week's top headlines and takeaways. Here's your host.
Welcome to Inside Towers Week in Review. I'm Leslie Stimson, Inside Towers Washington Bureau Chief. With me are John Celentano, our business editor, and Jim Fryer, our managing editor. This episode is sponsored by Inside Towers Intelligence. It's a quarterly market report that dives deep into the wireless infrastructure ecosystem. Intelligence looks at market trends, capital expenditures, relevant M&A transactions, and more. Intelligence is designed for managers, marketers, and investors. The 2023 Volume 3 is available now. An annual subscription also includes an exclusive briefing and online support. For more information or to subscribe, visit insidetowers.com/intelligence. John, you had a big earnings call week. Did you want to start off by discussing DISH?
We had a very big earnings call week, Leslie. I'm very tired, so I'm not going to talk very long. But there were some interesting developments for sure. Let me get to a couple of them. U.S. Cellular reported its results for the third quarter. You know, it's kind of struggling a bit in terms of top line and bottom line results. It's losing some subscribers. It's not able to attract new subscribers. It's not able to get its pricing up. Top line revenues were down somewhat, as was the adjusted EBITDA. But one of the bright spots in its performance is that it still owns its own towers, and its tower business is actually holding up reasonably well. Its leasing revenues grew 8% year over year to $25 million in the quarter. You know, it operates just under 4,400 towers across its 23-state operating area. And obviously, it's the anchor tenant for those towers. But, the company said it reported just over 2,400 co-locations. And these co-locations are really the big three, mainly the big three mobile network operators who are on the towers, and then a handful of smaller wireless network operators. So, its tower tenancy actually grew 1% year over year to 1.54. But and it also points out these towers are competitive. About 30% of them do not have a competing tower within a 2-mile radius. So it sees potential for more co-locations. We know, and the company wouldn't talk about it, but they have earlier declared that they're looking at options for what to do with the company, what to do with U.S. Telephone and Data Systems. Corporate parent is looking at, should they sell the company? Should they break it up and sell pieces? They didn't talk about it on the call, but there's been speculation that the towers are up for sale. Who would buy them is still a speculative, probably another tower company, obviously, would make the make a logical move. But so we're waiting to see how that plays out. DISH was the other big story for this week. Our headline was DISH is performing below expectations. And so what's happening is they are losing subscribers and are not able to add new subscribers yet. They have announced in July, and we covered this, that they're what they call their Boost Infinite program, which is really to bring 5G subscribers onto their standalone 5G network. So far, the only subscribers they have are with their Boost Mobile MVNO service that they acquired from T-Mobile. And those subscribers use both AT&T and T-Mobile networks. Well, they're losing those subscribers either to cable companies or to other wireless competitors. And as a result, their revenues are down, and their revenues are down 10% year over year. And their income was a loss for the quarter compared to a gain a year ago. The stock market didn't take too kindly to those results, and they whacked the stock by 37% in one day. This was at the close of trading on Monday. So, you know, the real question is what's going to happen to Dish? They have scaled back on their capital expenditures, which peaked in the second quarter when they met their second coverage requirement of 70% of the U.S. population. They met that in June. Their next bogey is in June of 2025, where they have to cover 75% of all PEAs in the country. So they did indicate they're slowing their capital expenditures through the end of this year and into next year, and probably it won't tick up until early in 2025 when they ramp up to try to meet that 75% coverage bogey. I asked them about how many cell sites they might need to meet that. They did say they're currently at about 20,000, and they're in the planning stages for what they'll need to meet the 2025 deadline. But you know, in the meantime, it's a struggle to stay above water. I mean, they're not making money. Their finances are upside down, and there's a lot of question about what will the company actually survive, or will it declare bankruptcy? They did announce earlier in the year, we covered this, a merger with Equistar, which is also owned by Chairman Charlie Ergen. And that supposedly will sort of reset their financial situation and give them a little bit of, buying power to raise more funds. But that's not a done deal yet. You know, Erik Carlson, the CEO of Dish, is stepping down. And the new CEO designate is the current CEO of Equistar. So, and then we're hearing a lot of chatter about layoffs, both, you know, in press coverage, and I see on social media posts, people have been discharged from Dish. So it's we don't have a full understanding of how many people are involved in this, but I think it's suffice it to say that there's enough involved that it's getting attention, and that it's indicative of the company trying to get its costs under control and or reduce its costs while it's you know, in line with its revenue decline. So this is going to be an interesting story going forward, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. So.
Yeah, there's a lot of legs to this story. It'll be interesting. Do you think, I don't know if you could speculate, what will happen when the Equistar guy takes over this coming week?
Well, you know, if they're sort of the, between the two companies, if they're the stronger of the two, I think he's going to lobby to Charlie and the board that, you know, he wants to have his organization really in place. And I'm speculating here, but you can imagine that, you know, he would want to, you know, put forward a plan where he said, look, we're already structured and organized, and we're doing reasonably well. We want to bring that to the overall organization. So let us move in this direction. And, you know, the people I see that are talking on social media about being laid off, they're all on the Dish Wireless side. So, I think we could see a restructuring of sorts in the mold of the Equistar management team. So, so we'll keep an eye on it. It's going to be interesting to see how it evolves. You know, the real question, I think, is will the government let Dish fail? I mean, you know, it set it up as to be the fourth wireless competitor and nationwide competitor. And if it goes away, then that kind of blows the whole premise of why Dish was created in the first place. But, you know, this whole notion of wireless competition has come up in other quarters as well. And, you know, what's the magic formula for a good competitive market? Is it four carriers? Is it three? We've seen this in other countries. I will tell you from my own analysis that prior to the merger, you know, Sprint and T-Mobile were also RANs. They really were not on par competing with AT&T and Verizon. It was like a duopoly and then a couple of other, you know, smaller players. But now we have three strong national players, and Dish would make a difference, but they're not at any scale yet to really impact that competitive analysis, other than, they have an offering that is competing with the big guys. So
interesting. We've seen bailouts certainly in other industries, but haven't quite seen it yet in telecom, which we fortunately we haven't needed it, but that could be coming.
Yeah, I think, Jim, that's a good point. The question would be who would bail them out? You know, is it a government bailout, or would they be sold off to a larger player? Would they be sold off to private equity, for instance? We know some guys that are out there that have pretty deep pockets and might like the idea of buying their way into the service side of the wireless business. I think there's many kind of scenarios you can play out, and it's going to be interesting to see how this comes down. So
we're not naming names of our deep-pocketed friends though yet, are we?
I don't know any deep-pocketed friends. the other story that I just wanted to highlight here is north of the border. The regulator in Canada, the Canadian Radio Telecommunications and Telecommunications Commission, issued a mandate this week directing the large incumbent telephone companies to open up their fiber to the home networks to smaller internet service providers, smaller competitors, basically. And as you can imagine, that didn't go over well with one big player, Bell, who said, if we're going to do that, then we're cutting the plans that we had to build out fiber to the home in our operating territory. They announced they were cutting their capital expenditure budgets through 2025, including a big chunk in next year in 2024. They did say they were going to scale back their targeted 9 million homes passed to about 8.3. And, if they have to comply with the CRTC directory, then they're going to do it, kicking and screaming and as much as they can on their own terms. But I think it just goes to show, even despite good intentions, where the regulator said, look, we have less competition now in the key markets than we had 2 years ago. There's been a lot of market consolidation. Some of the smaller players have been bought up by the bigger guys. And we've seen some significant mergers like Rogers and Shaw that have reduced the number of competitors in the market. And, the Canadian government's worried that, Canadians are already paying high prices for broadband and wireless services, some of the highest in the world. And they're looking for ways to, put a damper on that. But, anytime the regulator starts dictating market conditions, it's not a pretty sight. We've seen it in this country. The Telecom Act of 96 tried to dictate that the local telephone companies had to open up their networks to competitive local exchange carriers. There may only be a handful of those CLECs still around and initially there were about 1,000 that jumped into the market. So, anytime the regulator starts to use a heavy hand in directing how the market should evolve, it has unintended consequences. And, I think we saw that immediately in this announcement this week in Canada. And so we'll have to see how that plays out if the CRTC compromises or backs down somehow, or there's some agreements between some of the players to open up their markets to smaller competitors. That's going to be interesting to follow. So,
well, thank you.
There you have it.
I think the rest of us can just go now.
This Leslie Howe, when John reports on Canadian stories, the accent starts.
Oh, it starts coming out. Yeah.
Pretty clear, eh?
Yeah.
In fact, I'm wearing my CCM hat today, yep. And it's got a Canadian flag on the back. So, kudos to the Canadians.
That's right.
Yeah.
So this is sort of related to what we were talking about earlier, talking about Dish. Millions of AT&T and Verizon customers are trying to unwind T-Mobile's $26 billion acquisition of Sprint through a proposed class action lawsuit. You know, the T-Mobile Sprint deal was announced in 2018. It was completed in 2020. The Eastern Division of the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois, based in Chicago, will decide the outcome of the lawsuit. So in the document, the plaintiffs are claiming that AT&T and Verizon customers have had to pay billions of dollars extra for wireless service after the T-Mobile Sprint deal reduced competition because it cut the number of U.S. mobile operators from 4 to 3. And your question would, you know, one of the questions will be, well, what about Dish? Well, because Dish isn't really, I guess you could say it's not a viable fourth really national mobile competitor yet. So the proposed suit was filed last year. It seeks a range of penalties up to the undoing of the T-Mobile Sprint transaction. U.S. District Court Judge Thomas Durkin said in a ruling last week, the plaintiffs plausibly, that's his word, argued that the higher prices stem directly from that deal. He said the merger closed on April 1, 2020, just over 2 years later. Plaintiffs brought this putative class action on behalf of themselves and other AT&T Verizon customers. They're suing T-Mobile U.S. parent, Deutsche Telekom AG, T-Mobile U.S. itself, and T-Mobile U.S. investor, SoftBank Group Corp. Even though these are Verizon and AT&T customers, Verizon and AT&T, they are not actually part of the suit. But so these people are saying specifically, they allege that the reduced competition following the merger has caused class members to pay billions of dollars more for wireless services than they would have without the merger. And that violates Section 7 of the Clayton Act and Section 1 of the Sherman Act. The suit outlines their plans to unwind the deal and, quote, create a fourth viable competitor in the marketplace and recover damages for overcharges they allegedly paid. They alleged the deal meant that AT&T and Verizon were forced to increase their prices to remain competitive. That's what this hinges on. And, you know, it's not the first time the T-Mobile Sprint transaction has faced scrutiny. Several states filed a lawsuit to stop the deal from going ahead in 2019. 13 states and the District of Columbia sued to stop it in the Southern District of New York. They alleged the transaction would substantially lessen competition. The court favored the defendants and denied the request to stop the deal. And in early 2020, T-Mobile and Sprint settled with the state's attorneys general for Illinois and 11 other states. T-Mobile agreed to several additional commitments, including an extension of the consumer pricing commitments from 3 years to 5 years, low-cost plans, and a nationwide broadband internet access program. T-Mobile has called he has described their damage claims as speculative. It says if subscribers are unhappy with higher costs, they should switch to T-Mobile, not sue it. So there you have it.
That's a great line, and you really do have to wonder how do you raise prices, you know, and claiming that it's a non-competitive market. If you're competing, you think you'd lower your prices,
right?
But I, you know, we have data going back to the mid-teens showing that AT&T and Verizon were dominant. And as they are, and T-Mobile and Sprint were really, you know, quite a bit less competitive. So, and why wouldn't these plaintiffs go after their own carriers to say, you know, why did you raise our rates?
And, that part's puzzling.
You know, I think the rates were raised because the wireless operations of these two major players were the most viable. And these guys, if you go back through that period, they took on non-telecom acquisitions. to get into the media group that, that drove their debt, you know, way up, and saddled both companies with significant debt payments where they had to raise money. And where were they raising money from? Their wireless operations. So, you know, I'm not a lawyer and I wouldn't want to get in the middle of this, but you could make a case that there's other factors that are not being considered here that as to why AT&T and Verizon raised the rates, and, you know, not necessarily directly related to competition in the wireless space.
And there you have it. So that's a wrap. Thank you for listening to Inside Towers Week in Review. And a reminder, for a complete rundown of all the week's stories, check out our Saturday edition.
Thank you for listening to Tower Talks. To subscribe to our podcast, our daily newsletter, or use our other industry resources, please visit InsideTowers.com. Until next time, you've been listening to Tower Talks from Inside Towers, the wireless infrastructure industry's podcast.